This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Hey, get your fresh BizCast here. I'm DC Dennison, on location in Central Square, Cambridge, across the street from Art Interactive, which is hosting an exhibit by Glow Lab, a Brooklyn-based art group that is dedicated to studies of location, place, psychogeography. Right now there's a couple of guys in gas masks and white lab coats sweeping up in front of Art Interactive. I think it's part of some performance piece. I'll find out in a second. But first I wanted to talk about this week's BizCast, which leads off with Sasha Talkett talking about Scouts Inc., which is a Boston-based football research firm. We also discuss the destruction of the 406 Club at Fenway Park. After that, I hope to attach a few conversations with some of the curators of the Glow Lab Art Interactive exhibition. But first up, Sasha Talkett.
All right, so Sasha Talkett, you have just written a very interesting story for the innovation section on Scouts Inc., which sounds like a fascinating distributed group in basements and bedrooms all over the place. Give me an overview on Scouts Inc.
Well, what Scouts Inc. is, you know, think about whenever you watch ESPN, and you know, you watch the announcers on TV, and they start talking about all this really interesting stuff, and a lot of it's really inside kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, how football works and the nuts and bolts of it, and you know, very deep background on a player and that kind of thing. You always think, well, how did they get that?
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes the answer, not always, but sometimes the answer is this group called Scouts Inc.
Uh-huh.
And they are a group of former football scouts. And they go around and they dig up all kinds of information in exactly the same way that an NFL personnel department would do it.
Yeah.
So they basically mimic an NFL personnel department and dig up a huge database of information on various players all around the NFL.
And then just feed it to, like, ESPN and other places, too. I mean, NFL teams can track with that.
Right, so NFL teams actually buy this data, too, and they use it as a sort of second opinion on their own players.
Yeah.
So they have their internal department, and then they just want to make sure that, you know, they're sort of on the same page in terms of their thinking on a player. It never hurts to have another opinion.
Yeah, yeah. You hear these incredibly knowledgeable guys on ESPN, and until I read your story, I didn't realize that they are kind of huddling with a Scouts Inc. guy often before they go on to just sort of get his take on things.
Yeah, it's not as if Scouts Inc. is telling them what to say, per se. These guys are really smart on ESPN. They know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, these Scouts Inc. guys, they know a lot, and they're football guys first. They're not media guys. They're not reporters.
Mm.
And being a football guy first means you can explain the nuts and bolts of football.
Yeah.
And maybe you can sort of help explain things from a coach's perspective or a scout's perspective that, you know, the other reporters wouldn't think of. So they're bringing a new perspective to the table, and that works its way into ESPN's coverage.
The thing I liked about your story was the idea that these guys are in bedrooms and basements all over the place, that this is not something, you couldn't have built this company 15 years ago, because I'm sure they're all on the internet, they're all connected, they probably have kind of internal message boards where they're sharing stuff, so it's kind of a new model of a information company.
And in fact, most of the work that they do is for ESPN.com, so it really sort of shows this new model, and a lot of times they'll stay up all night drinking Diet Coke to try to finish their stories, and they're sitting at home in a spare bedroom, working basically all by themselves and communicating via email.
And also people pay for this information. The customers, ESPN, this is a premium product, right?
It is, and ESPN just loves this product because they think that, I mean, people are paying $40 a year to go on ESPN.com, and a big part of that is because they want to access this Scouts Insider data. I mean, this is the only place they can get this data is on ESPN.com.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that every website in the world is trying to find premium content that they can charge for. And here they've got this deep level of information harvested from these geeks, and people are paying for it. So, you know, that's an interesting model. And also it's something that you hear. People, I think, associate this kind of deep stats with baseball, so it's interesting to hear it in the football context. You know, people know about the sabermetricians and all that, but these guys are like that for football.
They are like that for football, and they're really into looking at matchups, which is something that I find very interesting. So which positions go up against one another, and where is there a mismatch? Of course, where there's a mismatch, that's where one of the other teams can try to exploit that.
Right.
And if you know what to look for in advance, and if you're ESPN and you know what to look for in advance, you can figure out highlight reels that you can show, and then you look really smart during the game, because you'll know where there's a mismatch and where there's likely to be a big play.
So it's not just the on-air talent that's using it. It's the producers are saying, let's cue up the matches with the Patriots secondary because there's
because the Patriots secondary is definitely mismatched at this point.
Overmatched. So that's interesting. And that the Patriots themselves don't use these guys, right? I think you made that pretty clear.
Yeah, the Patriots, you know, they just like to keep everything in-house.
Yeah.
And people from Scouts Inc. told me they tried to approach the Patriots. I believe it was Bill Belichick and Scott Pioli, but I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. And they had dinner with them, and they tried to get them to buy this content. But the Patriots just really want to stick to what they know. They believe in themselves. They believe in their personnel department, and they don't think they need any outsiders.
But it's interesting that they are like a personnel department. So you could see where, I mean, I could even see it. Could a team really outsource this whole kind of personnel research to these guys? Do you think they have it? They have their in-house, and they want these guys as kind of a foil to sort of bounce off.
Well, my guess is the team is never going to get rid of its in-house personnel department because that's your edge over the competition.
Yeah, right.
And when you're sitting there in that draft room, you don't want everybody else to have the same data that you have.
Yeah.
I mean, you want to figure out a way that you know something everybody else doesn't have, and you can pick that player that's undervalued and maybe really get a good run out of that.
Yeah.
And the Patriots, of course, are the kings of doing that.
Yeah. Do you think sports bettors are big into these guys? Do you think if you're putting down money on a bunch of games every Sunday, that would be clientele for these guys, that they'd be buying that service?
Could be. You know, I hadn't thought about it at all, but it's clearly very insider information.
Yeah.
And, of course, anybody who wants to get an edge one way or the other is going to look for insider information.
Right. Who's ever trying to get an edge? Right. Teams.
Right.
Gamblers, whoever.
I don't even know if Scouts Inc. has thought about gamblers.
Yeah,
I bet
not. They probably want to keep a certain distance there.
Right, I think they want to be far away from anything.
Yeah. Another sports story that you've just been covering today, you just came back from Fenway, and the destruction of the 406 Club. What's behind that?
Well, it was pretty dramatic scene. I mean, you know what the 406 Club it's like. It's this glassed-in luxury seating area. People have just hated it for years. Ever since it went up, people hated it.
Right.
And so today, finally, they held a big ceremony, and they took what's actually a concrete baseball, and they chucked it at the glass, and it shattered. And it was very dramatic, and there was TV cameras everywhere.
Oh, I'm sure.
And for a while, everybody thought the TV crews, they were getting so close that they were going to get hit by the shattered glass.
Oh, yeah.
But they sort of escaped, which was good. There were a lot of speeches, and it was just a really sort of upbeat kind of experience. People really felt like what was going in there was much better than what this is now.
Yeah. And what do you think, what does this say about the Red Sox and their approach to Fenway? I mean, is this the biggest change they've made, or with the Green Monster seats? I mean, how does this stack up in comparison to some of the other things they've done?
This set of renovations they're doing is going to be the biggest set of renovations in at least six decades.
Oh, really?
I mean, since the 1930s.
Oh, wow.
It's just a huge sea change in how they're doing things, I think. Because not only are they doing this particular set of renovations, but they're adding, I mean, several thousand seats over the next 3 years. They're adding 1,100 now, and then they're going to be adding thousands more. And they're going to be adding a lot of premium seating, which is what's going to allow people to keep all their stuff at Fenway. That's why we can stay at Fenway, is because the Red Sox are going to be getting a lot closer to what the rest of baseball has in terms of premium seating.
I see, because that's the real cash cow, is the premium seats.
Right, right. So the EMC Club is going to cost $275 a game to sit in there, and it's sold out already, they tell me.
I noticed you quoted Wade Boggs. Did you call him up? What was behind that?
Oh, I did talk to Wade Boggs, and Wade Boggs is a big critic of the 406 Club in general, and he felt that it really impacted his hitting, or the hitting of the whole team in the field. The balls that used to be carried by the wind and would go pretty high were getting sort of pushed down a little bit. And so a ball that might have gone pretty far was, you know, maybe an out, or maybe it was much fewer bases than it would have been before. This is overall opinion. So he was pretty happy when we talked to him on the phone, and he said that, and he heard the 406 Club was going down.
Well, I mean, we'll soon find out. I mean, next season, if it will be pretty easy to tell if there's some sort of difference, I think, in the wind currents.
Right.
It's the kind of thing that if they did baseball, it'd be perfect for Stats Inc.
Yeah,
you know?
they did. But, you know, baseball has a lot of people who do statistics.
Right. They don't need
statistics. It's hard to know if they need another group.
Yeah. Hey, anyway, thanks a lot, Sasha.
Thank you.
I'm here with Christina Ray, who's the curator of Glow Lab out of New York. We're here at Art Interactive at a raucous opening of Glow Lab at Art Interactive. Is that fair to...
Sure.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. So there's a million things going on, Christina. Tell me what holds this all together.
Basically, the organizing principle for the show and for what Glow Lab does is... There's a word that we all use, and the word is psychogeography.
Mm-hmm.
It's a word that's actually been around since the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is about looking at how you are affected by your environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how does the city really affect your emotions and your behavior, and vice versa?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we all do in our work, and all the projects in this show sort of represent that.
So what's an example if someone were to stop by here, let's say, you know, this week sometime, what would be something that would sort of, that you think sort of would sort of show them or illustrate that kind of interaction?
Well, I should mention, first of all, that we're open on the weekends. So
We're
open on Saturday and Sunday, 12 to 6. But if anyone who does want to come by, we have lots of projects that you can do that will take you out of the gallery to exploring the neighborhood.
Oh,
so,
I see.
For example, we have one project where, you know, we're doing something that people have done for a long time, which is launching messages, like a message in a bottle type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're doing is we're launching messages into the sky with helium-filled balloons.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's a sort of twist on that idea where it's very sort of high-tech projects. So people can launch a balloon, and anybody who finds the balloon has a message on it. They can log into a website and say, I found this balloon, and they can upload what they discovered onto the website. And we have a whole mapping system that tracks the balloons, tracks their progress, things like that. So it really takes people out of the gallery environment and into the city. That's just one example.
Do you feel like people are too kind of disassociated from their place?
They can be. I mean, we tend to find, a lot of us live in New York, and as in any big city, you find that people tend to follow the same path, you know, to and from work and home all the time. And so part of our just inspiration and our goals is to really try and disrupt those patterns and allow people to, you know, maybe take a left where they would have gone right and see something new that they hadn't seen before, and just always, you know, discover new things in the city, because we kind of think of the city as our playground.
Mm-hmm. So what, if you had to pick a place that really meant something to you, like in your personal life, something that, you know, a place that you feel connected to, what comes to mind?
Well, I've moved around a lot in my life, and I think that's part of what inspires me. But I lived in Japan for several years, and that's really where I became interested in exploring public space, because I lived in Kyoto, and there you find this interesting mash of high-tech buildings and skyscrapers with tiny temples and really hidden spaces.
Mm.
And I think it was exploring those spaces that really got me interested.
Mm. Do you feel like, what is the legacy of this in terms of when you say it goes back?
Sure.
Who are some of the artists that maybe listeners might be familiar with that are kind of on this same sort of path?
Well, in the late 1950s, the word came about through a group called the Situationist International, European artists and writers who were interested in disrupting the city patterns. And since then, the term, I mean, at that point, it was a lot of writing, not so much really interactive art like this. But then all through, you know, the 60s and 70s, a lot of conceptual art is sort of a takeoff on that. Artists like Vito Acconci have done work that we, you know, consider sort of psychogeographic. And then all the way up through the present. And now, especially with people using more mobile technologies, we really find that that's been, you know, a huge sort of regenerator of all of this kind of activity.
Yeah, that was my last question is, what effect does kind of modern mobile internet technology have on this? It seems like, you know, there are so many technologies that kind of can take you into a global space. Is that part of the mission is to sort of connect that global space back to real space?
Well, it's a lot easier to do that now.
Yeah.
And you find through the projects in this show that several projects are web-based or they use the internet in some way. It's been, you know, I would say the primary factor that has brought all of us together. Because we work with people in Europe and in Asia and all over the place, and that really wouldn't be possible without the kind of connectivity that we have. And we're also able to show our projects. I mean, people can look at what we're doing now tomorrow or later tonight and see the effects of just what's going on at this opening.
Yeah, yeah. Great. Hey, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Dignazio, you are the Director of Exhibitions and Programs at Art Interactive.
That's correct.
And also a collaborator with Glow Lab.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yep.
So tell me, how did this all come together from your point of view? How did this start?
Well, I started collaborating with Glow Lab about a year and a half ago as part of the festival that they do in New York called the SciGeo Conflux. And so that's initially where I made contact with Glow Lab, because apart from this job, I'm also a practicing artist. And so I did a project there, which put me in touch with them. And then it's a really interesting network of artists who are doing all of this kind of work. So, like, alternative methods of exploring space and geography, other than map making, which is, like, what we traditionally think of as, you know, how we map out space. And so what I did is I encouraged Christina to apply for Art Interactive's open call, open curatorial call for proposals. She submitted a proposal for Glow Lab to come to Art Interactive. It was approved by our curatorial committee, and that's how it happened. And then we've been working on producing the exhibition ever since then.
So what, in your own work, what's gotten you sort of interested in this sort of connection to sort of place and geography and that?
I mean, I think it's just all of these typical interactions that we have with space are produced from kinds of habits. So you have the habit of going to work, you have the habit of going to a particular dry cleaner or grocery store or, you know, whatever your habits might be. But then thinking of ways to get outside of that, and particularly ways driven by chance, for example, or the algorithm, the software algorithm, which is another one of those ways of getting outside of oneself and outside of one's own kind of individual, subjective kind of experience, and then seeing, you know, as a way of expanding your notion of place. Because, you know, we all may live in Cambridge or Central Square and think, oh, I know what Central Square is.
Right. You know?
And yet it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
And you can never obviously know the totality of a place. But then you can at least try to, like, begin to understand all the differences or all the different understandings of a place that exists other than your own particular experience. So, I mean, I think that for me is the both the kind of impossible challenge and the wonderful thing about these kinds of methods of exploring space, because they're infinite. You know, there's infinite ways of exploring, like the sidewalk patch outside of your door.
Right. So, you know, in a way, you're trying to sort of knock people a little off their or out of their rut.
Exactly.
Yeah, and see things in a slightly different way.
That's exactly right.
So what artworks here do you think do that particularly well? Which ones have sort of knocked you out of your groove?
Well, I think for me, I think there's a few that stand out. In particular, I mean, almost the simplest ones. So, for example, there's a project that's just called Hello, And what it does is it's a research project to say hello to strangers. And so one artist just walked around Central Square, Cambridge, and said hello to every person that she passed. And she collected data about that. And so she tabulated how many people said hello back or said something else or said nothing.
So what percentage said hello back?
I think it's very low. Something like
10%. So
it's an interesting kind of comparative study to do as well. But then she is actually going to be leading a group walk to say hello to strangers on Sunday. So we're all going to walk with her. I mean, that'll definitely transform the experiment, right?
Yeah,
is like
right.
having a group of 20 people walking down the street saying hello to one person.
Uh-huh.
But I think that... and then, I mean, I guess the other project would be, for example, the one that Christina mentioned with launching messages into the sky with balloons. And then the sound bike project, where there's a woman who created a bicycle that actually, when you ride it, it has these speakers attached to it, and the faster that you ride, the louder and faster the bike laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bike is actually laughing as you go through the city.
I see. I saw the bike, but I wasn't sure what it was going to sound like when it was moving.
And so you can check out the bike, and you can ride it around town and produce laughter.
Wow.
And then see what happens.
Yeah.
Sort of experimental project. So.
And these projects will be going on through the beginning of December?
That's correct. So they'll be going on until December 11th, every weekend. So Saturdays and Sundays mostly. Although we have some events on Tuesdays and Thursdays on the calendar, but it's mostly Saturday and Sunday.
And so people should check out
artinteractive.org, and then the calendar is located at www.artinteractive.org/calendar. And so there's the full calendar festival of events there.
All right, great. Okay, hey, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening, and check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.